Our next case, case number 5, will be United States v. Morris. Mr. Hillis.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office. And I represent Cedric Morris on this appeal. He raises two issues. The first is the government's breach of the plea agreement. The second is the court's misapplication of the firearm enhancement. Time permitting, I'll get to the second issue, but I want to concentrate on the first. As to the first issue, this was a Rule 11 plea agreement, where the government agreed to dismiss charges and to recommend that a particular sentencing range is appropriate. Apropos of that, paragraph 17 of the plea agreement said that the parties agreed to jointly recommend a sentence with a base offense level of 26, and then the succeeding paragraph discussed credits for acceptance of responsibility.
I'm not finding the range in the plea agreement.
It's not stated as such, Your Honor. That's why I'm piecing together the multiple provisions, paragraphs 14 and paragraph 17. Would indicate the range, ultimately, with a criminal history category of 3, total adjusted offense level of 23, but the guideline range then would be the 57 to 71 months.
But it doesn't stop there. It has the base offense level of 26, and mm-hmm. that's where they started. It notes the acceptance of responsibility mm-hmm. in paragraph 18, that happens. And then paragraph 20 says both parties reserve the right to provide the district court, et cetera, including any and all conduct related, any and all matters which might constitute aggravating or mitigating sentencing factors. So I don't see why, and then it's clear that the court is going to determine the range. I can't find the promise not to look at other adjustments. Nailed down the base, they've nailed down acceptance.
Can I draw Your Honor's attention to paragraph 14, and I'd like to read the first sentence of that. It says that the parties acknowledge, understand, and agree that the sentencing guideline calculations in this agreement represent the position of the parties on the appropriate sentencing range under the sentencing guidelines. The only calculations that are included then are in paragraph 17 and paragraph 18. Paragraph 14 acknowledges that everything has been considered. Take that in context with 17 and 18, and it shows then that the parties have contemplated additional enhancements, don't find that they're appropriate, and therefore the sum and substance of the plea agreement is represented in paragraphs 14, 17, and 18. At best, paragraphs 21 and 22 interject an ambiguity.
Well, but I looked carefully at paragraph 14 as well, but I guess it depends how you read the sentencing guidelines calculation. So the parties have come to an agreement on the base, and they've come to an agreement on acceptance. And that's important. I mean, those are not small things to agree on. So you read into this the idea that that is all there is to say about the appropriate sentence range.
So in a well-crafted agreement, if there was more to say, then the government would say, if there is more to say, some language to the effect, maybe additional enhancements apply. Those are not ticked out in here. And they should be.
Not in paragraph 14. I mean, later on in paragraph 20, it is.
Paragraph 21 and 22, paragraph 20, 21, and 22, don't go into any additional enhancements. And there's, you know, contract principles of interpretation about specifics, trump generals. There are provisions about accepting things where if something is stated and something is not stated to the contrary, then we are to interpret the agreement consistent with those sort of applications of basic contract principles. This is ultimately a government contract that it drafted, and if it wished to reconcile the difference between paragraphs 14 and 17 and 20, 21, and 22, it had the burden to do so.
Let me ask you this question. Another thing that the government argues is that it actually, even under your interpretation of all of this, never goes so far as to recommend anything else to the court. It answers the court's questions, it talks about underlying facts, but it never utters the words, you know, we think you should go, you know, higher or something.
Your Honor, in paragraph 12 of the government's breach, the indented two paragraphs, the government discusses what the range is now, and it acknowledges previously, I think, that the range that the parties anticipated was 51 to 71 months. And then it says that, as the court just determined, the advisory guidelines in this case are between 70 and 87 months, and says, in the government's view, Mr. Morris's responsibility falls closer to the higher end of that level than the lower end. So it does prompt the district court to impose a sentence towards 87 months.
Well, but I guess there's the other part of the agreement that you don't disagree with. The government agrees to recommend a sentence within the advisory guidelines as calculated by this court.
Yes.
So maybe it doesn't have to agree with how the court got to the range, but once the court states the range, they say we'll recommend within it, and they do.
So I think that, though, is again a disconnect or an ambiguity that goes back to this paragraph 14 and 17, where the government seems to have taken on competing obligations. This could be avoided, however, if the government simply recommends at that point 71 months. Then you're in both ranges. You're within the range anticipated by the parties. You're within the range anticipated by the district court. You don't have to advocate for the 87-month sentence that then is in breach, notwithstanding the arguments for the enhancements that I think were inappropriate all the way through with the objection letters to the PSR and so forth. But have the government simply stopped at that point and said, we recommend 71 months, Mr. Morris would be within the range anticipated by the parties, that the government notes it anticipated a range of 57 to 71 months, and it would be in the range anticipated by the district court.
But the parties anticipate that the court might not agree with their range, and the government's promise is limited to sticking with the court's range.
Well, I think the government's promise was more than that by virtue of 14 and 17 stating that it anticipated. Of the plea agreement, Your Honor, stating that it anticipated what the calculations would be, and it's limited to these things. I think it's clear, but even if it's not, then at best it's ambiguous for the government, and that breaks in favor of the defense, because plea agreements are to be scrupulously honored. They're supposed to be also interpreted in a way where if there's an ambiguity, it inures to the benefit of the defendant. The government drafted this plea agreement, and including language that appears to be cut and paste in some regards, because it mentions about dismissing charges, and of course that didn't happen here. Talks about career offender, and this guy's not a career offender. It includes this language in there, and if it had been drafted more particularly, it would have avoided these problems where it wouldn't have this disconnect between paragraphs, say, 14, 17, and paragraphs 20, 21, and 22. And so, due to the ambiguity, if not the outright breach, this court should find that the government representations have led to harm to my client that should be capable of relief under the plain air standard, and we've articulated the various factors, and I won't go into those unless the court wishes to hear me go on at length about prejudice and integrity and so forth. I'll concentrate.
We're familiar with the standard. You don't need to review it.
Thank you. I'll then turn to the second issue in the case, and that is about the misapplication of the two-level firearm enhancement. The district court relied on Harris, and in Harris it said a defendant's proximity to firearms is insufficient to show constructive possession. The district court in this case said that Mr. Morse's proximity to the gun and its proximity to paraphernalia was enough. So the district court's determination was based on proximity. Based on the very case the district court cited, proximity is not enough, and therefore the district court misapplied the firearm enhancement by saying that proximity was in fact sufficient. That is contrary to the law, and therefore, or the sentencing guidelines. Therefore, we ask this court to vacate and remand for the reasons I've articulated. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Proctor?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Benjamin Proctor, representing the United States in this matter. I was also the attorney in the district court on this matter. I think the judges, you've hit this on the head. It comes down to what did the parties actually agree to in this plea agreement?
And so I'd like you, in answering that question, to go back to paragraph 14.
Yes, sir.
Because it doesn't say the partial sentencing guidelines calculations or some of the paraphrases that I was suggesting. It just says the sentencing guidelines calculations. Usually that means what you think the range is going to be. And we know that there's a base of 26, and we know that there's either going to be 2 or 3 for acceptance. Obviously the government normally reserves the right to think about both of them, actually, especially that third point. So why doesn't this create some tensions or ambiguities by the time you layer back in the other paragraphs we've been discussing?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I agree that the calculations referred to in 14 do refer to paragraphs 17 and 18, which set forth the agreements of the parties as to the weight of the heroin, the base, and how that translates into a base offense level, along that Mr. Morris is going to receive 2 or 3 points for acceptance of responsibility, assuming he complies
with
the conditions.
So he's either 23 or 24.
But they also,
the court uses.
Sorry. But it also talks about the range. And the only range in that plea agreement is the range to be calculated by the district court. And that turns into what the government's recommendation is going to be. Paragraph 22 is absolutely crystal clear. It is the only provision of that sentence, or of that plea agreement, that states what the government's sentencing recommendation is going to be.
But the government never actually stands up and says, you know, we don't agree with your sentencing range, Your Honor, because we think, you know, it should have been the lower one reflected by paragraph 14.
No, Your Honor. How this played out was that the probation office issued its draft PSR, which included two adjustments, the adjustment for the firearm and then an adjustment for being a leader and an organizer. Mr. Morris filed objections to those. I filed a response to those objections in which I stated in my response, these are not specifically stated in the plea agreement. But I laid out the facts. Mr. Morris's objection was very brief. It didn't include any law and it had a couple of facts. So I laid out all the facts that went into what the court should consider on whether or not those adjustments should apply. I laid that forth and at sentencing.
You didn't say at the end of that, though, and therefore the government thinks you should apply.
I did, Your Honor. I did provide the government's opinion. I said, under the totality of circumstances, looking at this, what the law is, it probably applies. It's not cut and dry. Probably couldn't convict them beyond a reasonable doubt. But preponderance of the evidence is that somebody's connected to that firearm, and the evidence indicates, based on what we have in the record.
It's pretty slender, actually. I mean, it's down there in the basement, it's in the laundry room, other people are in the house.
He's the only one that had a bedroom down there.
Yes, Your Honor. There are other rooms in the basement. And from my recollection, I think there were three rooms and then this laundry room. Mr. Morris's bedroom was down there. There was his identifiers, medicine, parking tickets in his name, and this laundry room, which had heroin trafficking materials, and this firearm right next to it, was adjacent to that. Other co-defendant in this case who lived with Mr. Morris said Mr. Morris lived alone in the basement. The other people that were found in the apartment, including the housemate, and then two other people who nothing in the record that I can remember indicates that they actually lived there. They were just found upstairs at the time when the police went in to execute the search warrants. Nothing that I recall tied them to living in the basement or to the firearm or other things.
So if you were to describe your reasons for thinking this isn't a Harris mere proximity case, what would you say?
The issue with Harris was that that individual was packing drugs at various drug houses. That was his job. He would go to these drug houses and he would pack the cocaine or the other drugs, and people around him were carrying guns. Here we have Mr. Morris's residence. This is where he lived. He had control, the evidence indicates he had control over this basement. He's also an admitted heroin trafficker. He admitted to participating in the controlled transactions here, and the evidence indicates that he had been trafficking heroin for years. There were heroin trafficking materials in the basement. Somebody was trafficking heroin, packaging heroin for distribution in that basement. Somebody had a gun. The only indication is that Mr. Morris is that person. That is more than proximity in Harris, which basically says there wasn't anything in the record in Harris to tie Mr. Harris outside of the court said the AUSA's statement that, well, he was nearby and maybe he had control over that, over the area where the stash of weapons was.
To go back to the plea agreement issue, what is that first sentence of paragraph 14 doing in this plea agreement at all? Because it refers to sentencing guidelines calculations and a range when the plea agreement does not actually conduct any calculations or state a range. It just says we'll start at 26, acceptance of responsibility, and then it sets a drug quantity parameter, but it doesn't actually... I mean, those are terms of art as we use them in sentencing law. Sentencing guidelines calculations usually involves all of the applicable adjustments, enhancements, and reductions, and then a calculation of the range. And none of that is going on in this plea agreement.
Your Honor, I agree with that. That sentence could be deleted. It doesn't serve a great purpose. But what it does do is it does refer to calculations that follow from there. And the only calculations in this particular plea agreement relate to the base offense level and the adjustment for acceptance of responsibility.
But why are you referring then to the position that this is the agreement of the parties on the appropriate sentencing range when it doesn't calculate a range at all?
It doesn't, Your Honor. Certain plea agreements could conclude it, but in this one, the only reference to the range is the range to be determined by the district court. And so that particular language of that sentence doesn't serve a general, a key purpose in pointing to a range, because there isn't a different range in there. And I think that's fatal to the argument made by Mr. Morris in this case. He's trying to tie the government to a range of 51 to 71 months, but that is not the range that was going to be calculated by, or that ultimately was calculated by the district court. And the only provision for setting forth the government's recommendation in this case was going to be within the guidelines range determined by the district court.
So this is just an illusory promise?
I don't think it's an illusory promise, Your Honor. I think it does.
Well, what does the defendant get for it?
What from that sentence, Your Honor, the defendant doesn't get anything from that particular sentence. What he gets from pleading guilty is acceptance of responsibility credit, but he also, in entering that plea agreement, he knows that there are paragraphs 20, 21, and 22, which set forth that both parties can provide the district court with any information relevant to the sentencing process, and on any matter that is not specifically referenced in this plea agreement, they may make a recommendation on. And that is how the process played out in this case. When the probation office submitted their draft pre-sentence report, the government filed its response to Mr. Morris's objection. The district court heard argument from the parties and ultimately came up with a sentencing range of 70 to 87 months. The government's only recommendation during sentencing was for a sentence within that range. I also laid out for the district court that these provisions weren't included in the plea agreement. If the sentencing enhancement for the gun had not been included, the range would be 57 to 71. I outlined where they were going to overlap, and per the plea agreement, I said, Your Honor, the government recommends a sentence within the guideline range determined by the court. I will correct one thing that appellant's counsel did say. When I referred to at the higher end versus the lower end, I was referring to the amount of heroin on 400 versus 700 grams. I did not say in making my recommendation, and I don't think it necessarily matters, but I wasn't recommending for a high end or a low end guideline, just something within the guideline. I'm happy to entertain any more questions from the panel. Otherwise, I ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Hillis?
Most of what I was going to say in rebuttal, Judge Sykes, you already said. I'm not certain what my client got by inking this plea agreement. He may as well have open pled. In the government's estimation, the most central promise that you thought you had received in paragraph 14, linked to paragraph 17, would be for a recommendation for a particular range based on a total adjusted offense level of 23, but that didn't happen. Charges weren't dismissed, so he didn't get any benefit from that. I'm not sure what advantage he got by signing this plea agreement. That would give people shudders about signing plea agreements with the government, should that be the case.
Well, it's the kind of language that you would expect to see in a plea agreement where the parties actually have negotiated for a particular range, or to recommend a particular range. They can't bind the court, obviously, but
that would be...
That's read in context. That's not what's going on in this plea agreement. It's not of that type.
Your Honor, read in context, and assuming the agreement in its totality, if you read 14 in conjunction with 17 and 18, that does seem to tick off what the parties anticipated by way of guideline calculations. There were no enhancements that were specified, yet there could have been. So those omissions suggest to me that this was something that the parties negotiated and anticipated. Indeed, the government stood up at the sentencing hearing and said they anticipated a range of 57 to 71 months. The plea agreement noted, excuse me, the PSR noted the parties had a plea agreement that indicated a range of 57 to 71 months. The government never objected to that when it was in the PSR to say, no, that's a mischaracterization of what the plea agreement is. They could have done that under Rule 32. They did not. Those are things that all suggest to me that if there's not a breach, we at least have many ambiguities. Those ambiguities, again, must be construed against the government. As far as the two-level enhancement, the government said Mr. Morris lived at that location. Indeed, he did. And he was a commuter from still another location. So he lived in two different places. The residents in question had multiple people who came in and out, whether they were consistent residents or not, I'm not certain. But many of them had drug involvement. Perhaps all four of the people did. There's one person who's a co-defendant here. There are two other individuals who have drug connections that are spelled out, rather, in the sentencing hearing. So there's more than what the government said by way of locking
one. Would they leave their guns there?
Had they been called and questioned, we might have a better idea, but I don't know many criminal defendants or people who are trying to avoid the displeasure of law enforcement to step in and say, I'm sorry, that was mine. So leads me to wonder who's
mean
it
the
is.
Idea. I said, well, I just left my gun there.
Hard to imagine.
And I have nothing further unless the court has questions.
All right, that will do. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.